Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Angeli. This hour on the program, we'll talk about the continuing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Middle East. My guest this hour, national security analyst Anthony Cordesman, says that in Iraq, the United States needs effective long-term plans and patience. And in Afghanistan, he says there are serious security problems. The military conflict there is really, he says, an Afghan-Pakistan war. We'll find out more. Anthony Cordesman is the holder of the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You know him perhaps as national security analyst for ABC News. He's the author of more than 50 books, among them Iraqi Force Development and Salvaging American Defense. My guest speaks in Columbus today for the Mershon Center for International Security Studies. That lecture is full. No seats left. Welcome to Columbus, Anthony Cordesman. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Tony, if I were a presidential candidate and I wanted to level with the American people and be very straightforward with them, what would I say to them about the situation in Iraq?
Well, first, if you wanted to be elected, you wouldn't do it.
Yes.
But the perhaps more important point is that it isn't a matter of staying the course or leaving. Iraq is directly related to what happens in Iran, what happens in the Gulf. The Gulf is the critical exporter of oil and is becoming one of gas that supports the global economy. So what you'd have to tell the American people is there's no easy way out of the Gulf. One way or another, you have a strategic commitment that's going to be a very serious one through all of my first term. I think if you look at Iraq, you would be weighing the positives and the negatives rather than taking a strong stand. And you'd be honest about the fact that by the time you actually get into office in January of next year and pick your team, the realities on the ground are going to be what should be shaping things, not some kind of policy shaped right now. And some of the realities are positive. You are watching a systematic defeat of al-Qaeda. You have not had open major civil conflicts in spite of the fighting between the Sadrists and the Maliki and Iski factions. You haven't seen the problems become violent between Kurd and Arab at a level people feared. And you now have a state that has very high oil revenues. When you look at the costs of the war, the dollar cost, with luck, could go way down. When you look at the troop levels, the Iraqi forces aren't going to be some sudden success, but they do allow a systematic reduction in U.S. forces. If we were to have a president take office in January who ignored that, it would be extremely dangerous. But the other side of the coin is that any of those civil conflicts could become far more serious, almost without warning. To say you're going to stay the course, regardless of whether Iraq plunges into a major civil war, is in many ways as unrealistic as saying you're going to leave even if Iraq evolves toward success.
Mm-hmm. So if the presidential candidate were honest, they would be talking in terms of a flexibility, and it would be an indefinite message in a certain sense, wouldn't it? It couldn't be, well, we're going to withdraw troops on this schedule, we're going to stay the course, et cetera.
I don't think Americans, frankly, are prepared for the fact that our involvement in the Gulf is going to probably be a critical, vital strategic interest well into the next two decades, that the problems of Iraq and Iran are going to interact with the overall problems of energy supply in the region, that our economy is dependent on the global economy. Those timeframes aren't part of the reality Americans are willing to accept in politics. We don't like uncertainty. What we want are solutions which are simple and quick, and if they happen to be continuously wrong, well, eventually, we tend to get it right.
You say Americans, Tony. Would that be true of almost any populace you could think of around the world?
I think that other populations tend to be more used to the external realities of having to live with their neighbors. you don't have quite the same combination of pragmatism, which is what Americans are good at, and a denial that history takes time simply because most people in most parts of the world have had to live with their problems on their borders a lot longer than we have.
Mm-hmm. So we're a bit isolated. We're isolated by oceans, by geography, among other things.
And by political and academic culture. I think it's interesting when you look at our foreign policy journals or you look at the commentary even in our best media, how much of it basically assumes that you can get everything done within a year or so. It doesn't happen, of course.
Of course, that, in a sense, that's what the Bush administration told us about Iraq. You know, it'll be a matter of a few months. I believe Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and others said, we'll be out of there. It won't take long.
Well, I think the whole mission accomplished message is one of the more frightening messages in time. And the same was said in many ways about Afghanistan. The reality is that part of the reason that these have turned into long wars is that we didn't provide the forces or the money or the nation-building efforts. We went to war with plans to defeat a relatively conventional enemy. So far, our military have done a good job of evolving new tactics and ways of dealing with the military situation, but we still are at a position where when we look at even last year's budget submission, nobody really knows what we're going to be actually spending because the Congress hasn't completed action on it. And we still don't have a request for this year's budget, which will be the budget the next president inherits, which defines what the supplemental spending will be. This basically has been immensely costly in time, American lives, and American dollars.
Mm-hmm. That's not an unusual process for us, though. That's simply the way it works, I guess, huh?
It's the way it has worked, certainly, in both of the wars we're currently involved in. I think that one of the problems is that it is always easier to enter in these commitments without really accepting the dangers of escalation, the time frames, the potential cost, and watch the situation require more and more resources than it's ever been to make an adequate commitment when we start. You could say we did the same thing in Korea and Vietnam with different consequences, but that has been our post-World War II tradition.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we went to war in Iraq?
I think if you look at it, you have a great many different pressures. You had one group worried about the threat of terrorism, which grossly exaggerated Iraq's role as a threat outside Iraq. You had fears based on Iraq's behavior between, really, the Israeli strike in Iraq and the expulsion of UN inspectors with weapons of mass destruction. You had a group of ideologues that believed somehow we could transform Iraq into a model that would then transform the Middle East. And you also had the fact that many people thought that containment in Iraq was weakening and perhaps Saddam would somehow be able to go back to the position he enjoyed before the first Gulf War. There was a great deal, too, of misinformation about the cost of going into Iraq. There were many people in the interagency community that I listened to who warned again and again what the time, the cost, the level of U.S. involvement might be, but many people saw them really as sources of obstruction, as Cassandras, rather than people who were really trying to do their job and who knew the country.
Mm-hmm. You supported the war with some reservations, would that be right to say? And what was your support based on?
Well, when you say I supported it, actually, when I was asked that on Good Morning America, I said that I gave it a 48% approval rating, and that was based purely on how good the intelligence was on weapons of mass destruction. One of the things that I published before the war, and it really reflected what many people who were advising the administration said, was that the peace might well become a self-inflicted wound. There were a whole list of factors we weren't planning for. complications that we would have to deal with, that it would be easy to go in and defeat Saddam's army. But unless you were ready with nation-building and stability operations, our military successes would fail. Now, I think it's important to note in retrospect that for all of the people who were evaluating the war then, almost no one knew that the administration basically had chosen to reject the kind of interagency planning, that there was no plan for stability operations, and that we were talking about beginning to leave Iraq in 30 days, never having really made any effort to stabilize the country or ensure that it could actually hold together when we left. So criticizing what people said outside the immediate policy group before the war is, I think, a little unfair. The administration basically failed to communicate what it was doing.
Right. My guest, Anthony Cordes, has been with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the National Security Analyst for ABC News, and he's here speaking today for the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at The Ohio State University. And as we mentioned, that lecture is full. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email a comment or question to openline at WOSU.org. Tony, you mentioned al-Qaeda in Iraq being routed at this point. What degree is al-Qaeda a force in Iraq? I mean, how many people are we talking about and what degree of skill, et cetera?
Well, the problem we have always is we can get very, very rough estimates of core cadres. Supporters can vary so sharply and with such different motives that it's hard to estimate. People generally put al-Qaeda well under 20,000 in terms of core cadres and people who are involved in regular military operations. A lot of people put the estimate under 10,000. It is not an outside movement. It evolved within Iraq. The leadership was originally Jordanian, to some extent influenced by Egyptians, far more than by Osama bin Laden. It wasn't even called al-Qaeda until it had been in existence for 3 years.
This evolved after our invasion.
It evolved after our invasion. There was, of course, no organized opposition to Saddam. The questions about terrorism in Iraq were whether Saddam was supporting various terrorist groups, including al-Qaeda, inside Afghanistan and Pakistan, the one we normally think of al-Qaeda. But there was never a sort of feeling that there were independent terrorist groups inside Iraq except for the Shiite opposition to Saddam, which is an entirely different structure.
When we say al-Qaeda, what do we mean?
Well, it's an excellent question. And when you talk to people who work this on an intelligence level, they basically break it out by individual movement, affiliate, and faction. On a country-by-country basis, counterterrorism can't deal in generalities. It has to deal in specifics. To the extent there are transnational activities, you focus on the individual activities. Some of them are regional. Some of them are cross-border. Some of them do emanate from the kind of guidance you get from bin Laden and his advisors, who we think are in Waziristan in Pakistan. But I think if we think of it as a loose movement of affiliated groups, many of which joined al-Qaeda having been in existence for more than a decade and simply took on the name, and scattered in more than 60 countries, we get an idea of how diverse it is.
And if we talked about their goals, are there unified goals among all these diverse groups?
In broad terms, there are unified goals, but the goals, when you talk about them, are to create an Islamic state based on a fundamentalist approach to Islam, and fundamentalism here defined by people who are not, in any sense, mainstream Muslims, restoring a religious government or caliphate that would unite Muslims. Beyond that, trying to define what any of this really means differs so wildly between individual elements, and none of whom in general have ever governed anything or put things like this into practice, that it is very dangerous to go beyond ideology and assume there's any agreement on practice.
Why do you think this idea of restoring the caliphate took hold? Why do you think it has so much appeal?
I think that there are a whole variety of reasons. One is that secular governance failed in so many Islamic countries. Another is population pressures in extraordinarily young countries that happened at a time when what were once guaranteed state jobs began to disappear, where the educational system broke down under population pressure. But the other thing to remember is that when you look at core support for al-Qaeda or for these types of values, most Muslims, most Arabs, most people in the Islamic world categorically reject this belief structure. Its violence, its extremism, the fact that it is militant gives it a special kind of influence. People with guns have a status that people without them are never going to have. But that doesn't mean that these have broad popularity or support within the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Again, if I were a presidential candidate, you say the security situation in Afghanistan is really difficult. There was a recent assassination attempt on Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, nearly successful. What would you say to the American people, in all honesty, about Afghanistan?
I think the problem with Afghanistan is exemplified by the kind of briefings you get when you go out there. You have what are really good plans and techniques. You see, people clearly understand that you have to create a structure of political accommodation, that development, that the quality of governance are as critical as security, that security goes beyond defeating the Taliban or the other major extremist elements, that it has to be a rule of law that gives people day-to-day security. When you look at what's happening in the areas where the U.S. is actually able to bring resources to bear, you see a lot of progress in achieving those objectives. But the problem is that from the start, there were almost no resources assigned to the aftermath of winning in Afghanistan. There originally was no strategic plan, no aid plan. The strange assumption that democracy consists of holding elections rather than having responsible political parties and the ability to govern. You have never adequately resourced this war.
Why would that be? Why would planners not adequately resource a war in the reconstruction afterward?
I think that when you look back at this, it was a very highly compartmented effort. There was very little real understanding that this was a country shattered by conflict which began even before the Russians invaded in 1979. There was no real understanding of how weak the structures of governance and society had become. There was a strange focus on elections, on the central government, to the exclusion of virtually everything else. And at that point in time, the U.S. military was very much fighting this as if the Taliban were a conventional enemy. Remember, this began really in 2001. It took a long time for the U.S. military to shift, to create new manuals to deal with counterinsurgency. And to be blunt, the State Department has never caught up as an institution, nor has the National Security Council. There are some very, very good people in the field, but they are far too few in numbers. And even today, the civilian counterparts to the military, I would say most of the people who rotate in and out of Afghanistan and Iraq come with little qualification for the job they are going to actually be assigned to. A lot of them learn in process, but the civil side of our national security structure is horribly out of balance with the military side.
How would it be brought back in balance? What's necessary?
Well, both Secretary Gates and Secretary Rice have agreed to try to create a structure that would blend together, create adequate civil military teams, which would fund the State Department to go beyond diplomacy and beyond traditional aid activities to deal with these civil-military issues. There are plans in Congress and in the government to try to reach out into the civilian structure in the United States to find what we do have, which is a wide range of civilian experts outside government that could be in a sort of reserve corps to deal with these issues. But at this point in time, even if the Congress funds what Secretary Gates and Secretary Rice have requested, the new president is going to have to decide whether to move forward, and basically there won't be any changes until perhaps the second year of the next administration. We've been at war since 2001. To really make the changes people want won't begin till 2010.
Mm-hmm. Tony, when we say we're fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan, once again I'd ask, who are they? What are their goals? What do they want?
Well, you're dealing with, really at this point, two very different groups. The Taliban in the south has stayed very much the Taliban that Omar had organized, that was the Taliban movement, a traditional Afghan-dominated group. And it has a different structure, a different influence. The Taliban in the east, at least according to the kind of briefings you get when you're out in Afghanistan or Pakistan, has changed a great deal. It is more fragmented. There are rivalries for power. It cooperates with at least two other major Afghan Islamist movements. It is now developing steadily growing ties to al-Qaeda inside Pakistan. And there is a Taliban inside Pakistan, which is to some extent different in terms of tribal structure and orientation. But what is happening in the east is very different from what is happening in the south. And in some ways, this makes things worse because there's no clear hierarchy to attack.
Broadly speaking, what do they want?
Again, if you look at it literally, and there is website after website filled with material, what they want is to create the kind of puritanical Islamic state that is part of the ideologies that they have brought to bear. These are a mixture, even though people say that they are Wahhabi, which is Saudi, but rather of the neo-Salafi form of fundamentalism, which is very, very puritanical, not in any real sense mainstream Islam, which was developed in Egypt and which came out in the 1920s, and a separate movement which has had influence in Pakistan and with Pashtuns called the Neobandi. Now, again, in broad terms, people know what they want, but it's a very eschatological, religious goal.
Do they want to reestablish the kind of state they had in Afghanistan before we invaded?
Well, the problem is you really didn't have a state. The Taliban did not have time enough to consolidate power. It certainly was puritanical in the areas it occupied, but it was still struggling against other ethnic groups in the north. When people talk about recreating the form of caliphate that they're advocating, it is a little like the American Puritans who discussed a Christianity which never existed and a state which never existed. These are people who have created their own image and then said this is the origin of Islam. Hmm.
My guest, Anthony Cordesman, is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He's a national security analyst for ABC News, and we're going to take a pause here just for a couple of announcements, and then we'll be back on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Go for rich conversation on the topics that matter most. The radio is more responsive than the water cooler,
and we take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you really care about. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon starting at 2 o'clock here on WOSU 820, NPR News. In the weather forecast, scattered thunderstorms, widespread showers throughout central Ohio today with a high of 65 degrees expected. Mostly cloudy tonight, the shower is likely to continue, and then a chance of showers again after midnight, low of 52 overnight. Tomorrow, Thursday, mostly cloudy with a chance of afternoon showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms once again, and once again a high of 65 degrees. If you really want to go into the future, Friday, possibly cloudy skies and a chance of showers in the morning, but then partly sunny in the afternoon and a high, once again, of 65 degrees. Right now we have 61 degrees at our studios here in the Fawcett Center on the Ohio State University campus. And your membership with WOSU provides for the news and information that you rely on. And in this pivotal election year, your support is more important than ever. Please become a member. It's very easy. Go online to wosu.org/give. Thank you very much for your continued support of WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Andrew. We're talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, the Middle East with my guest, national security analyst Anthony Cordesman. Again, he's the holder of the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And my guest is a national security analyst for ABC News, the author of more than 50 books, among them Iraqi Force Development and Salvaging American Defense. My guest speaks in Columbus today. He's here for the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at the Ohio State University. That lecture is full today. We're at 614-292-8513 if you would like to join our conversation, and you can email your questions and comments to openline@wosu.org. Tony, we have the situation in Iraq. If I were being honest as the presidential candidate, would I have to say to people, look, we have to devote many more resources to this, not only money, but effort, time, planning, and we have to change the situation?
I think the honesty would really be that if we are to succeed in Iraq, and that at this point depends on the Iraqis, because we can't succeed in the face of any massive sectarian or ethnic conflict. It isn't a matter of more resources. We can't suddenly halt all aid because Iraq has high oil revenues. The fact is they can't spend it effectively yet. There's a lot of aid in governance and other aspects we need to give them. We don't need more troops, but we do need to be patient about how long it takes to create an Iraqi army. We keep talking about it as if it was next year, but you go out there and you talk to the head of the advisory team, and quite realistically, he talks about 2012 rather than tomorrow. We need to be honest about the fact that there are some things which we simply can't do with resources, period. Iraq is not going to be a model democracy or a model of the rule of law. It may end up being much better than it was under Saddam, but it is going to be something which has years of instability, perhaps a decade or more, almost regardless of what we do. There are simply too many tensions and forces at work for us to control them.
How do you get Americans on board for this? I mean, people say they're tired of the war. 60% of Americans say it wasn't worth fighting. How do you change that around?
Well, I think Americans, frankly, are saying this because nobody has ever explained the realities. Nobody has given them an explanation of what the cost of suddenly quitting could be. Nobody has asked them to actually make the kind of sacrifices in terms of dollars or time that may be necessary, or asked anyone to ever vote on the kind of plans that are needed to really ensure that we can succeed. What we've done in both Iraq and Afghanistan is perpetually make promises nobody can keep and act as if we only had one more year to go. Will the American people be responsive to the kind of time it takes to deal with these wars? I don't know. If they're not, however, we can't avoid it, because if we leave Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq, the problem doesn't go away simply because we're no longer fighting there. The problem of terrorism, the problem of energy supply, all of these issues are long-term issues. And the fact is that if Americans intend to live on into the future, they're going to have to be patient with the fact you have to shape the future.
Well, President Bush is visiting the Middle East and Israel. He's talking also to Palestinian authorities. He's going to Saudi Arabia and to Egypt. You said this is in terms of he's going to talk about the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. It's a bit like waiting for Godot. And what did you mean by that?
Well, I think the truth is that whatever happens, and the most we could get would be a cosmetic framework agreement, which would have its value. Anything that keeps the peace process alive for the next president will be useful. But it is literally waiting for the next president. When you talk to people there, they're not talking about success under this administration. What they're talking about is what will happen under the next administration. And unfortunately, that's not just ours. Very few people believe that this Israeli government will be in power. People really question whether Abbas will be in power. When we talk about the surrounding states, there are serious problems with the future of Lebanon, with the future of Egypt, where President Mubarak is not going to live forever. So essentially what we're doing is claiming success before the president leaves office by having a visit and seeking some kind of agreement. But the reality is that given the tensions in the Middle East, given the fact that Gaza is under the control of Hamas, a group which denies Israel's right to exist, that there's fighting between Israel and the Palestinians on the border with Gaza, that Abbas has tenuous control over parts of the West Bank, that Lebanon is on the edge of civil war, and Israel's tensions with Syria are serious, to talk about a sudden peace is frankly illusory.
Mm-hmm. For a new president, if you were advising the new president, what would be a first step?
I think the most important thing is to not do what President Bush did initially, which is because these problems are so severe and seemingly unrewarding, to back away. We can't impose a peace. We can't take some sort of position that blames either side and move forward. But what we can do is constantly try to bring the sides together, to offer incentives in terms of aid, working with Israel, working with the Palestinians, working with the Arab neighbors around the Palestinians to try to gradually create some kind of structure that will bring people back to serious peace negotiations and find a solution to the Palestinian and Israeli problem. And what this requires is constant effort and constant patience. And it requires also working with countries outside this. One of the partnerships that we have now that's critical is dealing with the United Nations, with the European Union, bringing Russia to, at least to some extent, into the equation, reaching out to Arab states, even if they're not necessarily pro-Israel or pro-peace, to see what we can accomplish. Is this going to promise that by the time the next president leaves office, we have a stable peace? Nobody can make that statement. The promise you can make is if the next president doesn't pick this up immediately and try, things are virtually certain to get worse for Israelis, for Palestinians, and everyone in the region.
Mm-hmm. So again, patience and long-term is what we're talking about here.
Patience, long-term, putting the resources into the effort. I think all of these things are critical, avoiding blaming the groups that are least willing to discuss peace. We have often been relatively careless in our rhetoric. And we need to be very clear about one thing. We have real enemies. Calling them enemies in that case is a very valid thing to do. Taking states and whole countries and calling them part of something like the Axis of Evil doesn't help at all. It simply alienates a lot of the people who might be persuaded to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Tony, you have a new paper apparently at least it's reported as the title, Covering U.S. Military Options for Dealing with Iran. Tell me about military options for dealing with Iran and what might be a reason that the United States would have to attack Iran in some form.
Well, first, one of the key points of the paper is to try to explain to people that we're really looking at three different sets of problems. They're not totally separable, but they are not the same thing. We have Iranian proliferation, which is a very critical shift in the strategic balance in the area, and counterproliferation is a key goal. In the near term, that probably can be solved through diplomatic means. We have the problem of Iran's intervention inside Iraq and in Afghanistan. That has been provocative, but it has been kept to limits which skate the edge of whether their military options are both necessary and useful. Simply going out and bombing training camps for groups that are coming from Iraq into Iran is, quite frankly, a waste of time. You don't really achieve any meaningful casualties, and you tend to create martyrs, but you can't allow just open smuggling of weapons or infiltration. And then, although it hasn't had as much publicity, you have a constant series of low-level events and encounters in the Gulf and a steady buildup of the naval branch of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards in Iran, which potentially can threaten offshore facilities, tanker traffic, and movement through the Gulf. If the Iranians push that, and the same would be true of pushing it in Iraq, then you may need very limited, very careful military options to demonstrate that we will not fail to react, but at the same time, we should not overreact. And I think the problem is that people have looked on all of this as if it was one set of options, and then we've had one war scare after another for 4 years, some of them fueled by some of the silliest magazine articles I've ever read, describing things which never happened by way of U.S. military preparations.
Are you referring to Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker, for example?
Which one? I mean, it seems like he throws it through the word processor and updates it about every year.
Well, he seemed to have a couple of articles that suggested the Pentagon not only had contingency plans for attacking Iran in terms of a bombing raid, but also, front burner plans.
Well, and he also talked about extensive special operations work inside Iran, and others have gone on, in fairness to Mr. Hersh, to talk about using carriers to do missions we would never use carrier aircraft for. There have been people out talking about how President Bush has a secret plan to go to war before the election. It's rather interesting that these secret plans were given with very precise timescales before the congressional election, and they're being recycled. The fact is that, yes, we do have contingency plans. We have about 25,000 of them, at least. They're all variants on a theme. They cover virtually any conceivable enemy in the world, as well as humanitarian operations and a host of other plans. So when you say the United States has a contingency plan, let me ask the question differently. If you were the United States government, would it be responsible not to have a contingency plan?
Well, good question. The commentator Pat Buchanan recently suggested that the chances of a United States air attack on Iran were about 50%, he thought, before the next election. Your comment?
Well, the problem is what kind of air attack? An air attack that's provoked on the border areas against specific targets in the Al-Quds force, which would be a very, very limited response. Air support if an incident occurs in the Gulf like the one that happened to the British ship and to a lesser and direct confrontation with our ships. Are we talking about an all-out attack on Iran's nuclear and missile facilities?
I think that's what he had in mind, yeah.
I think the problem with that is that the president has been cautious in his language. The Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs have all said that we are pursuing a diplomatic option. We have not built up the land-based air power for this mission, and reports of overlapping new carrier task forces have been wrong. I think that until we see something very, very dramatic by way of actual action on the ground, it's never possible to dismiss anything entirely. You can't disprove a negative. But this constant stream of war scares at this point in time simply doesn't have foundation in fact.
What Iran, I understand, cooperated with the United States in terms of the Taliban early on, offered us cooperation perhaps in Iraq as well. What do you see the government of Iran, what do they want in terms of the relationship with the United States?
Well, I think first we need to be very careful. This is not a united government. It certainly has different attitudes among its spokesmen. It has not been able to preserve even unity among the conservative elements around the president over basic issues like how to deal with the International Atomic Energy Agency and the negotiations on proliferation. When you go back to the cooperation in Afghanistan, you need to remember that for Iran at that time, having a stable Afghanistan that was not dominated by the Taliban was absolutely critical in terms of refugees, in terms of the threat to Iran, in terms of the pressure from what was a Sunni-dominated element on Shiite minorities inside Afghanistan. The cooperation had very, very strong motives, and it occurred at a time when the United States had seemingly, in a matter of days, destroyed an organized military movement which had controlled an entire country, the Taliban at that time. You go back to 2003 and you saw the Iranians abolish an overt nuclear program, according to a national intelligence estimate. It's important that that happened, but in 2003, it wasn't yet apparent what the problems were in Afghanistan. And we had just scored another seemingly decisive, massive military victory. What you've seen since then is Iran becoming more and more confident that it can exploit the situation, that it can seek to pursue its own advantages in Iraq, use the Shiite-dominated government there as a potential way of serving not only its own interests but defending itself, reaching out, stepping up their cooperation with Syria, operating inside both Afghanistan and Lebanon. So this is not the same government we dealt with earlier. We don't have the same position of strength. And it is a very opportunistic country whose motives and goals are probably much more determined by what they think they can do at any given moment than some kind of strategic master plan.
Tony, a commentator in Tom Friedman's column in this morning's New York Times said that the United States, in terms of the Middle East, was neither feared nor loved. It was perceived as weak. We weren't feared. Our opinions were not respected. And there was a feeling that we had to regroup and to reestablish our reputation there. Do you agree with that statement?
I think we are probably feared. We're feared both because of our military power and, again, because of the problem in terms of war scares relating to Iran and in much of the Middle East. We are feared because we are seen as the supporter of Israel and we are seen as taking sides. So one has to be careful here. But the public opinion polls, and there's a very wide range of them, some of them conducted by country, others by region, do show a massive deterioration in overall respect for the United States inside the Middle East. They show that what used to be the most serious problem for America in dealing with Arabs, which was Israel, in many polls is now third. What really has displaced it is the feeling that we have horribly mismanaged the war inside Iraq, and that our war on terrorism is actually anti-Islamic and anti-Arab. And I think that Tom Friedman is absolutely correct that one of the main goals of the next president is going to be to have to deal with those perceptions. The problem is they're scarcely unique to the Middle East. Those same polls, if you look at attitudes toward the United States in Europe and Asia, show that we've almost wasted a quarter of a century of American political capital in the course of the last 8 years. And rebuilding America's reputation and influence has got to be a very major goal for the next president.
How does a new president go about convincing people that, you know, our moves against terrorists are not anti-Islamic?
I think a lot of it is rhetoric. A lot of it would be to strengthen the country teams that we have in Islamic countries, to not deal in broad generalities, to be far more careful about what we say, to understand that if we fight the war on terrorism in ways which arbitrarily imprison people or which do not very, very carefully select out the people who might really be guilty of terrorism from the vast majority of Arabs, Muslims, and foreigners, we create new enemies or people angry at us rather than defeat terrorism. A lot of these ideas and suggestions are ones which the administration gradually has already begun to adopt. But I think the other thing is to understand that we can't simply say to the world that you can solve all your problems by becoming Americans. You're going to have to show far more respect for other cultures and other societies if you want those societies to work with you in defeating extremists like Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. And unfortunately, our rhetoric has been very, very parochial and somewhat extreme and isolationist.
Tony Curtis been with us with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, and you know him as National Security Analyst for ABC News, 614-292-8513. Mark is with us on the phone. Hello, Mark.
Yeah, thank you. Great program today. Just like to ask your guest, if to get partisan for a second, if he is familiar with Barack Obama's position on Iraq. It seems to me to be a little bit reckless. I think he alluded to this at the beginning of the show. My understanding of his position is that we're getting out of Iraq regardless of what's going on the ground. And since it seems that the surge is working, and perhaps there's a chance for a better resolution than just pulling out, his position seems to be, again, reckless. Also going to ask, if you could, what is it going to take to get these factions together over there politically? Is it just going to be enough of the bloodshed that they've had enough, or is there going to be anything else? And I did have a final question. What motivation does Iran have if it believes that it can produce a nuclear weapon in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whenever? What motivation do they have to negotiate if they calculate that we are not going to use military force? If you could answer those three questions, I'd appreciate it.
All right, let's give a go at that.
Well, let me begin with Senator Obama's position, which really isn't all that different from Senator Clinton's. I think it's obvious that when you are running for nomination, you run for your party base. Democrats oppose this war far more than Republicans do. But if you parse out the language that Senator Obama uses, there are always escape clauses as to how quickly you withdraw and the conditions that will exist when he comes to office. So I think one has to remember that Jimmy Carter came to office talking about withdrawing U.S. forces from Korea. And that particular initiative lasted for about 3 months and never had a tangible form. I don't think the candidates are irresponsible, but given the partisan character of American politics, they take partisan positions. I think when you talk about the factions in Iraq, the thing to understand is, for all of the people involved, this is a matter of survival. It isn't a matter of suddenly dealing with rational sort of negotiations and becoming friends. They're going to have to work out a new balance of power between Sunni, Shiite, Kurd, and other minority. They're going to have to restructure the political system, the way the economy is handled, how they deal with oil revenues. They're going to have to find a new balance between secularism and religion. We are doing, I think, our best to quietly encourage them. We have to be quiet. It isn't a matter of being noisy or compelling people. Threatening to leave doesn't make people accommodate each other. But it's going to take time if it can be successful, and it may not be. Your third question is a very good one. Under this government, it may be extremely difficult to stop Iran from moving forward, particularly now. The problem has always been they have all the technology they need to build nuclear weapons except for fissile material. Whatever could have been done at some point, and it's really doubtful it would have succeeded, now they have more advanced centrifuges. Even if we did carry out a strike, there's a good chance they could then create a dispersed facility hidden that we couldn't target and begin to get nuclear weapons anyway. We can try the diplomatic option. We can hope for internal political change. But frankly, we may well have to deal with military containment, working with other countries in the region, simply because we can't stop them at this point in time.
Can we live with a nuclear-armed Iran, then? We can find a way to do that?
You can live with virtually anybody. It isn't desirable. But I think, again, this will be, at least initially and for some time to come, a very primitive nuclear capability. It will be up against a vastly superior military power. It is perhaps more a weapon of intimidation than a weapon of warfare.
All right. Pete, if you're very quick, we have time for a question. Hi. Pete, are you with us?
Yes.
Very quickly.
I just wanted to ask whether you think Iran, we have lost Iraq to Iran already. And are they grooming this guy, Muqtada Sadr, to be the future leader? I mean, it'd be easy to put him in there if they keep assassinating presidents, and then he steps up to the plate and takes the presidency later.
Well, he's not, at this point in time, somebody who is tied to Iran. If anything, he has been more of a nationalist than many others who are actually in the government. But the fact here is, does Iran have influence? Yes. Has that influence grown over the last year or two, particularly over the Shiite elements inside Iraq? Yes. But are any of these elements somehow dictated to by Iran? Are they people who will be pro-Iranian as distinguished from being nationalist? I think as long as they feel that they have our support for a while and we're going to leave, that they're not dependent on Iran for survival, there will be a question of who's using whom, but Iran's influence will remain limited.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies here to speak for the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at The Ohio State University. Tony, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us this morning.
A pleasure. Thank you.
When we get back, an open forum at listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.